You're listening to the APSE Podcast, the Association of People Supporting Employment First, with your host, Chris Davies. Today's podcast is brought to you by Reach for Resources, a nonprofit providing individualized, competitive employment services for people with disabilities. We believe our community is a better place when it is inclusive and everyone, regardless of ability, has the chance to be successful. Learn more at reachforresources.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Season 5. Can you believe it's Season 5 of the Minnesota APSE Podcast? And this is Episode 1. We're so excited to kick off our first episode here, as we were all just talking about getting ready to brace for the Arctic blast coming in later on this evening. We're very excited to have Aaron Wycombe here with us today. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. Aaron is a senior labor investigator with the Department of Labor and Industry. Did I say that all right, Aaron?
Yep.
All right. And he has a lot of wonderful things that he'll be sharing with us as we get to know him and some of his background and the work that he's done. Very excited about that. As Aaron knows, and some of you faithful fans out there know, we like to start out our podcast by talking about what APSE is, what Minnesota APSE, stands for, what we do. And in case there's, somebody watching today that has never heard of us before. So APSE, A-P-S-E, that's the Association for People Supporting Employment First. And I know my guest today fully is behind that belief and movement, is an organization that is one of the only true membership organizations, national membership organizations, that solely promotes integrated, customized employment for people with disabilities and other barriers to employment. And it's a national organization with almost 50 state chapters. We're getting there. We still got about 10 to go or so. Where are we at, producer? 40-ish. 40-ish, yeah. Last I checked, we had 50 states. So I guess my statement was pretty accurate, about 10 to go. And Minnesota has been around really since the beginning. And we really focus on really trying to not only engage with the community, spread the word, provide training and, policy advocacy as we can. We started this podcast as a way to help us do some of those things, to get the word out, to meet wonderful people like you, Aaron, that are, can tell us their story and some of the current things they're working on, in the world to make not only Minnesota, but the whole country a more inclusive place and opportunistic place for people with disabilities. So very happy to have you here. We're going to do a visual description first. And I am a white male, still got a red beard, getting a little more gray especially on the chin area. I'm bald. Today I'm wearing blue jeans and one of my standard checkered white and blue shirts with my vest on today, since it's going to get so cold. And how about you, Aaron?
Yeah, I'm a large white male. I have brown hair and some brown facial hair. I'm wearing all black clothes today, black dress pants and a black, I guess, fleece, you would call it.
Yeah, I call that a fleece, absolutely. All right, great. Thanks so much. All right, well, Aaron, let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, first, if we'd all just like to get to know you a little better, tell us a little bit about your background and, even growing up, things you've done, how you got here today.
Sure. So I'm a Minneapolis, Minnesota native. I've been autistic since the day I was born, and I've been involved in autism advocacy for many years now, and that's, I guess, the reason I'm here today. And I said thank you for having me earlier, but it is a great honor to be here. I've watched the podcast, and you've had on many great guests over the years. including a lot of people that I've worked with closely over the years. Jillian Nelson at the Autism Society of Minnesota. Elise Knopf, my old boss at Voc Rehab Services. So, yeah, I'm happy to be here.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I have, I would say, a law and technology background in terms of my education and training. And I've been a Minnesota public servant for a while now. I worked at DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, in the Voc Rehab Services division, so supporting disability employment. And I now work at the Department of Labor and Industry, where I conduct labor standards investigations, not specific to disabilities, but for all workers in Minnesota, making sure people are paid appropriate wages, have their earned sick and safe time, and other workplace protections are being enforced, things like that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Do you feel that things are trending in the right direction? I think, as you and I both know, we have a long way to go, but you were really in there, you know, sort of peeling back the curtain of a lot of things. Do you feel like businesses are trending in the right direction in terms of their practices for not only people with disabilities, but all people?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly in, I mean, it feels like yesterday, but it's been, you know, more than 5 years since the pandemic, COVID pandemic began. And I think a lot of, changes in the workplace have, been driven, by, that great disruption to all of our lives, particularly the greater flexibility in the workplace and the rise of remote work has helped a lot of people with disabilities, in addition to just the workforce as a whole. And I think employers, in part due to labor pressures that exist today, a lot of employers have lots of vacancies and have a need for workers in a variety of sectors. So I think that demand is also driving higher disability employment. But yeah, I do think we're trending in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, during COVID, it seemed to me that we all had to figure out a different way to conduct business. And at least what we've experienced with, you know, in my my full-time job life, I'm a, you know, part of a group that is practicing and helping people find jobs. We found that people are more willing to try things differently, you know, to think outside the box a little bit. Certainly never would say that COVID was a good thing, but it does have its positive effects as well. Is some of the really tough ones. So can you tell us more about your legal background? If I understand correctly, you have a law degree from the University of Minnesota. Is that right?
Yeah, I do. And I have worked on a variety of disability law issues over the years. Yeah. But originally, I specialized in sort of business and corporate law. Prior to coming to the state, I worked in federal public service for a time at the FDIC, okay, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the national banking regulator, doing e-discovery, which is sort of like using data analytics tools and just manual review with your eyeballs of documents related to bank fraud investigations related to most of what I worked on was related to the aftermath of the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008, 2009.
Yes.
Before that, I worked in the private sector at a variety of Fortune 500 companies as well as some smaller businesses and nonprofits doing just a variety of corporate compliance things related to incorporation, keeping nonprofit status or keeping whatever entity status the business operates under, and yeah, a variety of other things too. Privacy law is a big one.
Yeah. Would you say a lot of those experiences have you know, really come into play with the work you're doing now as a, you know, senior labor investigator?
Yeah, I would say I think I've I've had a variety of work experiences in my life, and I do think a lot of the work I've done at the corporate level or in general counsel's offices for corporations does inform my work. I also think a lot of the first jobs I've had in food service and landscaping, those jobs are sectors in which there's more labor standards violations. So, yeah, having that lived experience, and my family's originally from Austin, Minnesota, where Hormel is based. It's a big meatpacking company town, and meat processing is a major industry where there are labor violation issues going on. So, yeah, I think my lived experiences have prepared me well to do these sorts of labor investigations.
Absolutely, absolutely. On a less serious note, Austin, Minnesota is the home of one of my favorite musicians, the Gear Daddies.
Oh.
Martin Zeller.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about let's get into talking about advocacy. You've done a lot of advocacy, you know, as you said in the beginning, for people with autism, particularly around employment discrimination, outcomes. Tell us about some of the, you know, things you're doing with advocacy and maybe some examples, any stories that you can tell.
Sure. So, I mean, I think it all started with developing my own self-advocacy skills and seeing some of the challenges I've faced in the workplace over the years, working in a variety of environments. Different things come up related to autism spectrum disorder and some of the communication and socialization difficulties that come along with that. And yeah, I've been fortunate enough to be in a position working with different local nonprofits over the years, working with the Autism Self-Advocacy Network, which is a national organization, as well as the Autism Society of Minnesota.
That's who Jillian is with that you mentioned,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. With other groups on different mentorship opportunities and helping people on a walk-in basis. And then obviously when I was with VR, a huge part of my work was helping individuals with finding and maintaining competitive integrated employment and negotiating reasonable accommodations and other, you know, issues and barriers that come up in the workplace. So yeah, I think I've been fortunate enough to see on the ground issues and studying, you know, empirically the larger patterns that exist too.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned, you know, Jillian Nelson earlier, and have you done some testifying, you know, like she has, and have you been, you know, in session, things like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've lobbied before the legislature, both with individual legislators and giving testimony as well on a number of bills I've been particularly active in Connect 700 reform. Sure. The Connect 700 program, mm-hmm. for those who don't know, is helps people with disabilities generally, but particularly communications impacting disabilities. Individuals like myself who cannot participate in the typical interview employment screening process are able to demonstrate on the job through a trial work period their skills and be able to get hired that way. And that's specifically a state employment program.
Right.
So that's the a unique program that the state of Minnesota has. There's only one other state, Nevada, I believe, that has a similar trial work program. And just other what we call same state as a model employer policies. I think it's very interesting that particularly in autism employment, a lot of the innovation and a lot of the promising programs have come from the private sector, and autism representation is less common in the public sector and in nonprofit organizations like universities, healthcare institutions, where you would think the mission would drive greater representation and more equitable employment practices. So I think there are steps being taken by the state of Minnesota to reform that program, to increase the number of Connect 700 certificates that there are, and the number of employment opportunities that are available to persons with disabilities. But there is still a long way to go.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. You know, as we were saying before, I think we've come a long way, but there is still so much further to go, and it's a journey. You know, we'll probably always be on it, right?
Absolutely.
So with the Connect 700, my understanding, if you want to be considered to be a candidate, if I'm saying that the right way, you basically apply and get accepted into being a you know, that would be considered a job candidate within that program. Is that right?
Yeah, sort of. Job postings in Minnesota, they're all available through the same online portal. I think it's just careers.state.mn or something like that. And the vast majority of jobs explicitly say they're Connect 700 eligible. There are some that are not, particularly temporary positions where it's just not feasible to go through the whole trial work period process for a job that's only going to be 6 months long anyway.
Right.
Certain executive positions are still not Connect 700 eligible. But for the vast majority of positions, you are able to apply as a Connect 700 candidate. And the process is there's a particular office in Minnesota, Management and Budget, but you can just Google Connect 700 and you'll find it. And you apply to get a certificate. You basically need just some form of medical documentation, a letter from a physician or another healthcare provider that says this person has a qualifying disability.
Sure.
And then MMB would issue you a Connect 700 certificate. They used to be time limited, but now the majority of certificates that are issued, I believe, are lifetime certificates. And then you're able to go through, apply for the job as any other candidate would, but there's also an HR contact you email, and they'll set up what is called a non-competitive interview.
Okay.
So it's not... there are constraints on the type of questions that the hiring manager or the other professionals can ask. There's constraints on the people that can be in the room. Usually it's only the hiring manager and potentially an HR professional from that agency. So
could the person also have a representative with them if they have a support person or something like that?
Typically not, but okay. Obviously that's something you can negotiate with with the HR team there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and that's to avoid these sort of panel interview issues that come up that can be a barrier to people with communications related disabilities.
Okay.
And yeah, so the questions in the interview do also need to be narrowly tailored to the job, the requirements of the job, the specific required qualifications and the duties of the job. They can't ask broad general questions that sometimes trip up people on the spectrum or people with other disabilities. It needs to be focused on what the qualifications for the job are. And if the hiring manager thinks you meet those qualifications through your resume and through that more informal, non-competitive interview process, you go through a trial work period, and it's called Connect 700 because the trial work period can last up to 700 hours, which is about 6 months of full-time employment. And yeah, once they see that you can do the job, then you get transitioned out of the Connect 700 program. For most state positions, there's also another probationary period on top of that before you're a permanent employee. But yeah, that's typically what the process looks like.
And all the positions are just in the just state positions, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that I've been pushing for years is at least allowing other public entities in Minnesota the ability to opt in. University systems, MinSCU or the University of Minnesota. I've had teams there that are potentially interested in adopting the Connect 700 model for their employment because in most instances they use a very similar online system to the Minnesota Careers one anyway. So it theoretically wouldn't be that difficult. Or just other local government entities. The vast majority of public sector jobs in Minnesota are with city governments, with school districts, with parks districts, other things that are not directly state government but are state-funded public sector positions.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for rolling through that with us. Before the podcast started, we were getting to know each other. You used a term, something like acronym soup. Is that what you said? Mm-hmm. Is that what you said? So speaking of acronym soup, there's an acronym called E1MN. And I was wondering if you could tell, you know, our audience what E1MN is and your role / involvement in it.
Sure. So E1 is just Employment First, and MN is Minnesota. And Employment First is this sort of model that's been adopted in different states throughout the country, including Minnesota, where the underlying assumption is that all people are capable of competitive integrated employment. That's another acronym we use that I'm sure a lot of our viewers are familiar with, but competitive in the sense of part of the mainstream, part of and integrated too. Both are referring to just jobs that are in community where people can participate equitably. It's not a sheltered workspace where the individuals with disabilities, we don't get the ability to interact with the general public or work alongside non-disabled individuals.
Right. And, you know, as not everybody out there listening might know, but, you know, people from Minnesota APSE were part of a very integral part of the team that got the whole Employment First policy passed in Minnesota. Is there anything specific you can tell us about that you do to, you know, sort of grow and bolster E1MN in this state? And what you're seeing in other states?
Sure. So I think the Employment First framework is very valuable. I think, yeah, I do think Minnesota has been particularly good in embracing that model. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think part of that does stem from these same state as model employer policies that we're putting in place to try and get the state to be set standards that the private sector sees as, wow, this is really working, and this is a valuable, untapped community of prospective employees that we can utilize. And yeah, the culture shift, I think, that just that one simple assumption that all individuals are able to participate in the same employment environment, with or without reasonable disability accommodations is a very valuable one.
Yes. Yeah. To make any, you know, movement go forward, you have to have that belief system behind it. You know, that's the foundation. And to me, you know, that's what Employment First, you know, really means, is that, that we believe people that want to work can work, and it should be the preferred first option, you know, that we're considering. So you're not opting into work, you're opting out of work if that's not what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, we talked a little bit about, or you did, about advocacy, you know, particularly for people living with autism. As it relates to employers, what would you say would be, say, the top three things you can think of that are a need for employers, you know, to maybe understand better in terms of, you know, hiring practices and opportunities?
I think, I spoke a little bit about it before, but I think a lot of things, we notice this across the disability advocacy mm-hmm. space, is that a lot of the changes that are universal design principles that benefit everyone, particularly benefit people with disabilities, and a lot of the things that are developed to increase disability inclusion are things that end up benefiting everyone in the long run. I do think the remote work, the rise of remote work, has helped tremendously. But we see this in other areas too. I do think there is a sort of there are some assumptions that come with people on the autism spectrum that a lot of employers have. I think there's a lot of times when employers say they are developing an autism-friendly workplace mm-hmm. or environment, they specifically mean sensory-friendly, and those are particularly important considerations. A lot of us on the spectrum have photophobia or phonophobia, sensitivities to particular sounds or more intense light. Mm-hmm. Can be valuable, reasonable accommodations or inclusion practices. But I think because autism is a social condition or a social difference the solution to a lot of the problems we have in terms of autism inclusion are social themselves. Sometimes an autism-friendly workplace just means a friendly workplace,
yeah,
where people on the autism spectrum are included, are treated just like every other person, and the communication preferences of people are respected. Sometimes, and technology has helped a lot with that too. Sure. The rise of remote work has helped a lot with that. There's a lot more flexibility with different forms of written communication in addition to verbal communication. I think that's a huge difference maker. But yeah, those are some of the things I think employers need to realize about autism employment in particular.
Yeah, and the accommodations you talked about, particularly the autism-friendly workplace, is really just a friendly workplace. In my experience, almost every accommodation is universal, and it's just the way we all would want to be treated.
Yeah.
Would you say? See, I've always kind of believed that there's a myth that employers or just people in general might have about people with autism, and I'm asking you because you can answer this, better than I can. But I've always, believed that people with autism are individuals, right? And just because someone has autism doesn't mean they experience their autism the same way another person does. Just like all the things I experience aren't exactly the same way anyone else does. Do you agree with that, or can you speak about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's a popular aphorism with a lot of autism organizations and professionals that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. Mm-hmm. And it does impact everyone differently. I do think there are commonalities, though, and mm-hmm. Everybody on the autism spectrum, definitionally, at least if they have had a medical diagnosis,
okay,
has social or communication barriers and also has some form of repetitive or restricted behaviors or interests.
Okay.
But again, what those interests are varies widely, sure, from person to person, just as it does for neurotypical people. And yeah, I think that's an important thing to understand. And the communication barriers vary widely too. Some autistic people are nonverbal, or prefer to communicate in different ways. And some have more advanced language acuity and skills. So yeah, it is called a spectrum for a reason. There's a wide variability in people's abilities in different areas of life on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate you, sharing your thoughts on that very much. You know, I have a personal saying that I've said to myself for quite a while, which is plan for the future, but live for today. And as you and I are obviously sitting here on this podcast, at this very moment, making the most of it, right? Living for today. We like to turn and talk a little bit about the future, So love to get your thoughts on the future for employment, not only in Minnesota, but you could even take it as far as U.S.-wide and even worldwide if you want, on what your hopes and dreams are and beliefs are for the future.
Sure. So I think there's increasing recognition of the serious issues and disparities that exist, mm-hmm, for autistic people, and there are things that a lot of us are working really hard to accomplish. to rectify some of those long-standing problems. But there is progress being made, but I think this is a thing you'll hear a thousand times on this podcast and elsewhere in disability advocacy is there's progress being made, but there's a long, long way to go. One thing I did want to highlight that I perceive is we talked about this a little bit before the podcast, but there's a sort of what I characterize as a missing middle problem. You hear that a lot in housing affordability advocacy. There's, you know, apartments that have 100 units, and there's single family detached housing, and there's not a lot in between. To cater to people who have, you know, want different housing options or need something that's more affordable. And I think that exists in autism employment too. I think there are great programs, particularly in the private sector. There's an organization called Disability Inn that does excellent work with corporate partners like Microsoft, SAP, that do a great job recruiting and retaining autistic talent for particular technical roles and people that have advanced technical skills. And then there are some great programs that exist, like Project Search or other customized employment options that exist for people that I don't like to use the terms like high functioning and low functioning, but
neither do I.
For individuals who have autism and also have intellectual or developmental disability issues beyond that, or who are nonverbal or who have behavioral constraints. Mm-hmm. But there's the vast majority of autistic people aren't high functioning savants or quote unquote low functioning. They're somewhere in the middle, or they have some barriers that can be mitigated or done away with through reasonable accommodations, but they work really well in different areas and can be very successful. So it's just a matter of finding a way to match people's skills and interests with the employer need and the different areas of work that are in high demand right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you just described in a nutshell is why customized employment continues to grow, because, you know, the way to help somebody find a job that they're going to value and be valued is with that one person. You know, that's why customized employment, you work with one person at a time, and that employer is meeting that one person, like you you talked about. So, yeah, and you've also done a lot of work around 14C, or trying, you know, the work towards eliminating 14C. Love it if you could talk to, you know, our audience a little bit about that, and maybe start out with, for anybody that might be watching today that doesn't know what 14C is, maybe starting with that and some of the work that you've done.
Sure. So a lot of the labor laws that we have today started in the time of the Great Depression, including the main labor standards law at the federal level, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and Section 14C of that law allows employers to apply for certificates that allow them to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage. In Minnesota, the current average sub-minimum wage is between $3 and $4 an hour, so about a third of what the state minimum wage is, which is $11 an hour, and about one fourth of or even one fifth of the minimum wages that exist in the Twin Cities metro sure. area, which are above $15 an hour. So, but theoretically, and it happens in some cases, people are paid, you know, pennies an hour right. for work. And I just find that fundamentally unfair. I think a lot of people have come to appreciate that it's just there are lots of alternatives available to sure. help individuals get out of most of these places where people are paid some minimum wage are what we call sheltered workspaces, which are segregated from the rest of society. Often have restrictions, have unfortunately higher rates of abuse in the workplace.
Sure. Yeah.
And there
sort of shatters the myth that it's a safer place to be.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and I think we in Minnesota passed a law. Very recently in May of 24, where we're finally in the process of phasing this out mm-hmm. gradually, which is a very good thing because Minnesota used to have on a per capita basis by far the highest number yeah. of sub-minimum wage workers. The only two states that had more even a couple of years ago were California and Pennsylvania, which have much higher populations than
yeah.
we do.
Yeah, that's astounding to think of.
Yeah, and I think the incentives are starting to shift, and that's long overdue too, because even 5 years ago the state was spending on grants and incentives for sheltered workshops $240 million a year. And that's $11 for those programs for every $1 they spend funding or incentivizing in community work placements for people with disabilities.
Wow.
Which... thankfully, those things are shifting, and mm-hmm. in a few years, there will be no more sheltered workplaces right. in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that that hundreds of millions of dollars in discretionary funding can go towards disability employment that's actually in the community
yes.
and helps people with disabilities mm-hmm. to be helps us to be economically empowered, makes us less dependent on welfare systems, allows us to have at least a basic amount of money to mm-hmm. to use as we see fit. That's just a huge part of it. It's not just survival. It's just having the dignity of having a few dollars to just right. use however you want to use to explore your interests. That I think is a
Department of Labor is in the midst of doing a federal phase out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think at the state level, we fell one vote short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if everybody, you know, heard that, but our producer was pointing out that the phase out that has passed is federal phase out, mm-hmm. not in state. One vote short last year.
Correct, yeah. And we have passed state bills over the years to develop task forces
yes.
and commission studies to mm-hmm. Lead towards phasing out
yes.
sub-minimum wage employment.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, we're yeah. we're still not there yet. It's
no.
still – and I do think it it's not beneficial to the many people working those sub-minimum wage jobs to just have things close overnight. I think a gradual phase-out is important to allow mm-hmm. individuals the opportunity to go through a customized employment process or some other job discovery process where they have a chance of not having an economic disruption mm-hmm. and be able to secure jobs in community. I think that's a problem that we've had for a long time, is that we have these horrific institutions where we lock people away, and then we have, you know, a mental health deinstitutionalization like we had a few decades ago. Yep. And then if you don't have in-community support services in place, you're just dropping people on the street,
right,
which is not much of an improvement.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that infrastructure and, you know, thoughtful planning is definitely important. And, you know, I see this happening you know, maybe it's not happening because the law dictates it, but many practitioners, organizations are deciding just to stop doing it, stop paying subminimum wage, and start only helping people find, you know, customized, integrated, competitive employment. I've always said sometimes the best way to stop some or to start something is to stop something, and more and more people are definitely making that decision. And as you said, there are task force, there are groups that are out there training organizations that want to be customized employment practitioners and how to do it better. So, yeah,
I think that. I think as there's increased visibility on this issue, and the general public starts to learn a bit about it, they realize that a lot of these 14C employers who are paying people subminimum wage in segregated workplaces are nonprofit organizations that receive lots of public funding.
That's
and
right.
are institutions that otherwise do great work. Mm-hmm. The largest 14C subminimum wage employer nationally is Goodwill Industries, and they're called Goodwill for a reason. They have a lot of goodwill, and they do a lot of good work. But there's this one area where I think hopefully they realize that the indignity and the unfairness of subminimum wage is just bad optics for their organization generally.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a great point. I mean, in all my years of talking to private sector employers about hiring people, not one of them suggested, oh, can I hire this person at less than minimum wage? They don't even know what it is. They don't they've never heard of 14C. Don't even know it's an option. So, and it really was something that was designed to help war veterans, you know, coming back from the war, you know, have employment. So it's a very archaic, antiquated law and system that some people are still using.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like, they're called CRPs. In law and policy, community rehabilitation providers,
right,
or something like that.
Right.
And they were set up decades ago to be places where people can develop workplace skills over the short term. It's not intended to be a long-term employment situation, yet some people have been caught in this subminimum wage system for decades.
That's right.
When hopefully, I mean, the goal of these institutions was to help people develop work skills and be able to find jobs in their communities.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, I think we're getting pretty close to wrapping up. This has been a you know, wonderful conversation. Really enjoyed it, Aaron. Is there any words of wisdom, or as I like to say, if you'd like an audience member out there watching us and listening to us right now, you know, take with them from this conversation.
Sure. I mean, I'll repeat one thing I said earlier. Autism is a social difference, and the solution to a lot of the problems that autistic people like me face is also social. It's not something that can be easily enforced from the top down. It's a culture change that has to take place where people are just more flexible and friendly mm-hmm. to one another.
Yeah.
And that's going to have to be a gradual societal change. And it is happening, but I encourage people just to get involved and to, if you know an autistic person, just ask them how they're doing. It's not terribly complicated stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. Really appreciate it. I've appreciate your time today. You're doing some wonderful things, and really appreciated the way you articulated your ideas, and it was just a real pleasure. Great way to kick off season 5.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, all right. Well, as you know, Aaron, and you faithful fans out there, when we close up, we just like to remind everybody out there, if you can believe it, you can achieve it.